The next case is 08-2487, State of Ohio versus Michael Lepardus. Ms. Shigartis.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, Mr. Sleeper. My name is Sarah Shigartis, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Michael Lepardus. With me at council table is amicus counsel, Timothy Huey. We will be splitting time, and I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
You need to watch your time there.
The legal premise that this case is founded on is that the state violates a defendant's due process rights when it destroys materially exculpatory evidence. This case is the next step after this court's precedent in State versus Gieslin. In State versus Gieslin, this court was presented with the situation that the state destroyed the evidence after an OVI investigation. However, this court found that the evidence that was destroyed was only a small portion of the initial stop and that the remainder of the videotape was preserved that represented the rest of the OVI investigation. This court found that particular fact dispositive of the fact that that type of evidence would only be potentially useful rather than materially exculpatory. Implicit in that holding is the recognition that OVI videotapes that capture the entire OVI investigation are distinctive and unique and are the type of evidence that would be used to establish the accused's guilt or innocence, and therefore are the type of evidence that could be materially exculpatory and are the type of evidence that are the appropriate evidence for to have this court answer the question.
What was the charge in this case?
The charge that Mr. Lepardus was eventually convicted of was the impaired, not the per se charge.
But he was charged with what?
I believe he was charged with initially a per se charge, as an OVI per se charge, as well as an OVI impaired charge,
He refused?
No, there was a portable breath test taken on the side of the road, and then later, after he was arrested, Mr. Lepardus again took another breathalyzer test.
And the result of that was?
The last test that he took, I believe, was a 0.10.
And at the roadside?
And at the roadside, I believe it was 0.114.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask you about the bad faith issue. You seem to be asking us to create a new standard of bad faith. In your brief, you say ignorance and ineptitude equal bad faith. We've never had that standard before. Why should we change a standard that's common in the law? I mean, the standard of bad faith is pretty clearly defined. Why should we change that standard just to apply to police officers? What's the rationale for that?
Well, the rationale is that I'm not necessarily asking this court to define the state's misconduct as bad faith in order to shift the burden of proof from the defendant to the state. The lower Ohio appellate courts seem to agree that when the state fails to respond in good faith to a defendant's discovery request and a request to preserve the evidence, that the burden of proof should shift from the defendant to the state.
Well, you make the statement that Trooper acted in bad faith when he destroyed the videotape. Are you saying that's not really your position?
Well, there's two questions there. It's whether or not the misconduct, the first question, which this court accepted the proposition of law on, was did Trooper Forshee's misconduct, does that warrant shifting the burden of proof from the defendant to prove the value of the destroyed evidence to the state? The bad faith in the context of the traditional definition that's used in terms of malice, intent, that is typically a definition that has been applied in the young blood potentially useful avenue.
So you want us to set a different standard for bad faith in destruction of evidence cases than applies in other types of cases?
No. I would ask that this court, or I would say that this court does not need to address the bad faith issue because it doesn't get there. The first question that this court should address is whether or not that evidence was materially exculpatory. The way that this court, and it's the way that this court makes that determination, that Trooper Forshee's conduct will come into the analysis.
So you would want us to find that if they're just negligent, that does not shift the burden of proof. The state still has the burden of proof, even if they were negligent.
Even if they were negligent, yet. If the state's actions result in the destruction of the evidence, yes, and the burden of proof should shift.
So are you abandoning the bad faith argument, or?
No.
I'm a little confused.
No, the bad faith argument, it's an alternative to the proposition of law that was put forward, which was that the burden of proof that it should remain on the analysis of materially exculpatory. When evidence is materially exculpatory, bad faith on the part of the state does not come into play.
Although counsel in Geesland, we addressed that issue and said that it's the burden of the defendant. Unless the defendant can show that the state acted in bad faith, the state's failure to preserve the evidence is not a violation of due process. I mean, we specifically stated that in Geesland.
Right.
So you would have us extend the idea of bad faith, as Justice Stratton is talking about, to shift the burden and say, no, it should be the state's burden to show that it was not bad faith. Is that what you're saying?
No.
Aren't you saying that regardless of how the tape or the evidence was obliterated, it doesn't matter, whether it's negligence or an intentional act by the police officer, the burden should shift to the state because it's their fault, however it happened. Isn't that your argument?
That's part of the argument. The other half of it is that that this comes into play with this type of evidence. There was in Geesland, this court said that recognized that when you have with OVI videotapes, they are special and unique in the fact that they capture the entire offense. They capture from the moment that the lights go on, through all of the tests to the moment that the defendant is placed in the cruiser, all of that evidence is preserved. And amicus counsel can expand on exactly how important that evidence is.
Well, but, counsel, in this case, it didn't capture the breathalyzer reading, did it?
Well, it captured the
taking of the breathalyzer test, but the result that was the basis for the per se violation, which your client was found guilty of.
No, Mr. Loupartis was found guilty of the impaired charge, not the per se charge.
Okay. All right.
Well, counsel, I want to come back to what you said the threshold issue is. Materially exculpatory.
Correct.
I'm still having a hard time understanding. Let me deal with that standard. You argue the state should have to prove that the evidence that was destroyed was not material exculpatory, rather than in this case, the defendant had to show that. Is that correct?
Correct.
So the threshold question is, who has the burden of showing that?
Absolutely.
So it helps us not at all, or helps me not at all, I guess, to be persuaded here that, in fact, it wasn't materially exculpatory in this case, which I'm having a hard time understanding how it could be. But irregardless of that, you would say this should go back.
I would say that this should go back to the trial court, and for the trial court to either have another hearing where the
state has the burden on that.
Where the state has the burden, and for the trial court to apply the proper test.
All right.
Yeah, at this time I would like to reserve the remainder of this for...
Could you humor me just by telling me why it is materially exculpatory?
Why it is materially exculpatory? This
or why it potentially could be.
Right. Yeah. This court identified as much in State versus Gieslin when it said that it's this type of evidence is the type that the state would use to convict Mr. Loupardis.
First of all, the driving, if you don't dispute the driving.
He was driving, no.
And what you don't dispute that there was probable cause to stop, right?
Right.
And so tape or no tape, doesn't matter. He's stopped. He gets asked to, based on the officer's observations, and smelling alcohol is not going to be reflected on the tape either.
Correct.
Gets asked to blow on the onboard machine, which gives the officer then probable cause to take him down to the post headquarters or the police department and take another test, which he did. Okay, so I'm lost as to how the film here is materially exculpatory.
Well, it would be insufficient for the state simply to submit the breathalyzer test as the only evidence of impairment, because again, this is not a per se charge. This is an impaired charge. The state has to prove that he was actually impaired because of the alcohol in his system when he was driving. With the portable breath test results would not be admissible at trial. So what you have is the breathalyzer test back at the police station, that it never got to the point where there were any challenges made to the breathalyzer test. And the breathalyzer test, if it showed 0.10, that is very close to the legal limit. I believe that there at least would be a question for the jury as to whether or not he was actually impaired when he was driving, and the videotape would have been the only objective evidence other than, you know, this case is a perfect example of the nearly impossible burden. The nearly impossible likelihood that anyone is ever going to be able to meet the burden of proving that something would absolutely be materially exculpatory or absolutely not be materially exculpatory. There's different. The tape is going to show points where he was where it could lend to show that he was impaired and that it could lend to show that it wasn't. There was a hearing where Trooper Forshee testified. He did well on some portions. He did not do well on others. But all of that goes to the ultimate issue of whether or not he was impaired, which is a question for the jury to answer.
Well, counsel, does your client, strike that, but the jury was entitled to receive the information about the breathalyzer, correct?
The one at the police station.
Yes.
Assuming that everything was...
They heard that.
There was no trial. He pled no contest.
All right. But they would be able to hear that into evidence, correct?
Correct.
Provided it wasn't suppressed for some other extraneous reason.
Right.
And then the officer can testify as to the mode of operation of the vehicle that was his initial signal that there was a problem with this driver, correct?
Correct.
And in this case... The trooper observed your client speeding.
Correct.
Okay. So the combination of the breathalyzer plus the operation of the vehicle contrary to traffic laws, you're saying that's insufficient to support a conviction for impaired driving?
I believe there has to be a connection between the violation of the traffic rule and the blood alcohol level test. Yeah, there needs to be a connection made. So is it possible?
How is a roadside sobriety test where he's standing on one foot or walking the line or whatever? How's that going to reflect the fact that the officer, there's uncontested, that he was speeding, in other words, operating his motor vehicle in what could be considered an impaired manner.
And again, amicus counsel has much more experience and can answer this question much more clearly than I could, and I hope that he will address this question. However, when it comes to how he would fight this charge, he could have been speeding. Many people speed and are not impaired. There are people every day get speeding tickets and they're not under the influence, and that.
But the totality of the circumstances here, with the demonstrative breathalyzer, the smell of alcohol, the bloodshot eyes, linked to the speeding, doesn't that support the charge?
It does, and the evidence that would have supported the fact that he was not impaired was destroyed. The objective evidence that would have shown, or that could have shown, and this is the whole point. It could have shown that Mr. Loupartis was falling down drunk. It absolutely could have shown that. However, it's just as likely that it could have shown that he was not, that he performed these tests well, or that the trooper did not perform these tests in substantial compliance with the regulations, which would have discredited the trooper's testimony. Speed charge was dismissed, so there was no testimony given. There was no evidence given as to the exact speed of which he was going, and that type of evidence.
Counsel, the effect of your rule, if we were to agree with you, would be that if the police choose to videotape anything, they would have to preserve those tapes until the case is over, or the case could be potentially dismissed for that basis. Is that what you're telling us?
Yes.
Okay.
And that is the policy that the Highway Patrol testimony was given in this hearing, that it is a policy of the Highway Patrol to videotape this type of stop for exactly the reason that an impaired charge is such an opinion-based offense that the videotape usually assists the state just as often as it assists the defense.
Is there anything in our record, Ms. Regardis, that would indicate how an individual could get erase confused with record? In other words, when you say the trooper pressed the wrong button, is the machine here? Is there?
No.
Is there anything we can look at in the record to determine how an individual who's been ordered by a sergeant to assist or to make a tape? I guess McDonald told Trooper Smith
to make the tape,
to record it. Smith leaves the room and Forshee is by himself. What process? Is there anything in our record to tell us what process it was? You push erase instead of record?
The transcript submitted as part of the record. If you the motion hearing held on November 9th of 2006 is the hearing at which time all three officers testify, including Trooper Smith, Trooper McDonald, or Sergeant McDonald and Trooper Forshee. And Trooper Smith describes the process, not perhaps in detail, that there are no pictures given of the video or of the actual machine. However, he does describe that Trooper Forshee asked him if he could help him with it, and I tried to explain to him how to do it. There's two buttons on the machine. You can go from cassette to DVD, or you can go from DVD to cassette. And so I explained it to them and thought he knew how to do it. So I left the room. He started making his tape or his DVD from cassette. And when I walked into the room, 25, maybe 30 minutes later, I looked up on the screen and didn't see the picture, which means that Trooper Forshee was in there for 25 minutes with a blank screen, as the only objective evidence here was being destroyed.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Patterson, you've used your time, and I do want to give Mr. Huey some time. So, Mr. Huey, take a take a minute. As usual, the first advocate uses all the time, and so, Mr. Hewitt.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, Mr. Leeper, members of the court. Ms. Regardis asked me to participate in her oral argument primarily because I have been practicing in the area of DUI litigation for approximately 25 years. In fact, it's a destruction of evidence case that you know got me here as my primary focus being DUI. 23 years ago, my best friend was charged with DUI, and he later was the defendant in Columbus versus Forrest, which is a case that was decided by the 10th District Court of Appeals and has set basically the baseline for all of our courts of appeals on how they deal with the destruction of videotape in a DUI case. What our courts of appeals have said is there's basically kind of a different matrix. You can look at it as four different processes that could happen in a DUI case where the video is destroyed. If there's no request for preservation of the videotape, or there's just a general request for evidence, and it's destroyed in its normal course, what our courts of appeals have said is that is a young blood type scenario where there's no request, then it's young blood, and you have to come in and show that it would have been material exculpatory. What our court of appeals have said is in the situation where there is a specific request, as we did in Mr. Forrest's case, went over and handed the request to the prosecutor's office, directed to the prosecutor, and ask them to preserve the video. In those kind of cases, if nothing is done, if the state takes no action, then our courts of appeals have said not that that is bad faith, but it's different from Youngblood. It's no longer under the Youngblood scenario, and we treat it as if there was bad faith. That's become more.
When you say treat it, do you mean conclude there was bad faith?
No.
Or they investigate, or that's a facet to be explored?
The bad faith, we're trying to figure out how to deal with these cases. And a lot of our case law in terms of the preservation comes from Brady and Agar's, where it's a disclosure situation. So we use terms from the disclosure situation, and in Youngblood, they talked about bad faith, and in Youngblood, the evidence, the distinction between this case and these types of cases in Youngblood is, number one, in Youngblood, there was not a specific request. Number two, the evidence was neutral. The evidence could not have been determined by the officer looking at it. It was a blood sample. He didn't know whether it was going to help him or hurt him. So what our courts of appeals have said in Forrest, Benson, Benton, all of our courts of appeals are pretty much in agreement that where there's a specific request for the specific DUI video and the state does nothing, then we basically treat it as if, you know, we don't say it's bad faith, but we say it's so important that they should have preserved it.
Well, do they follow Brady and say that that constitutes a due process denial because of the destruction of the evidence?
Absolutely. It's on the same term. It follows Brady and, more importantly, Trombetta. Trombetta was a case where there was a specific request. And they said that it's a due process violation because it violates the defendant's right to an access to evidence. Talking about whether or not this videotape would be of any benefit to Mr. Lepardus, in the first place, obviously this court's decision is going to cover not only cases where there is a breath test or there may be some other type of test, there's going to be cover cases where there are no tests. But more importantly, as this court has looked at in Geislin, the time of a DUI case where from the stop of the vehicle to the time when the officer says you're under arrest, that is a very important time in the DUI case. You can have a speeding ticket. Speeding does not make someone guilty of DUI. If you have a breath test in that case, and not all cases have breath tests, some have blood, some have urine, some have none. Sometimes the officers can't obtain a test.
You need to move along.
Yes. In those type of situations, this court has said in State versus Vega, in limiting the defendant's ability to challenge that breath test, that the most pertinent evidence in trying to combat that breath test would be some scientific testimony, but in conjunction with evidence that the individual was not impaired when he was doing the field sobriety test and when he was doing the roadside test.
Let me take you down to what we have to write with the facts of this case. You would argue that because the request was made for the videotape and ultimately it wasn't preserved, that the state has the burden of showing that it would not have been materially exculpatory in this case.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so it would have to go back. I think you would agree, given the facts in this case, the state may be able to show that we still get to go to trial on this because we have enough speeding, odor of alcohol, bloodshot eyes, which aren't going to show up on the video.
Actually, they are these days, but.
Well, all right. Well, but we have enough to get us from probable cause for the stop to probable cause to take him down and make him blow in the breathalyzer. The gap, if he can stand on his head, it isn't going to save him from going forward on the criminal trial.
Absolutely, Your Honor. There are a number of instances where this case could go back down, and I would say it's very possible, if not likely, that Mr. Loupartis may still be convicted, but he'd at least have the access to the evidence to defend himself. This case could go back. One of the things we haven't talked about, and we believe that if there's a situation, again, if there's a specific request and the tape is not preserved, then we believe that the burden shifts to the state, but we think the state also should have the chance to come in and be able to show that it was destroyed by an act of God, some type of situation where there's absolutely no...
Well, we know how it was destroyed. It was a mistake. He pushed the wrong button. Isn't that what happened?
That's correct. And what we're saying is... And
that's not an act of God, is it?
What we're saying is in terms of creating a decision that's going to cover these cases, we would say that there are situations within that matrix where there's a specific request, but for no reason whatsoever, the state was not, to their own fault, was not able to preserve the tape. There also could be situations where the trial court may consider whether or not the state took sufficient, given the unique nature of this evidence, took sufficient steps to protect that videotape.
And if it did not, what would you recommend? Is it,
if it did not,
dismissal?
If it didn't, well, no, I would recommend that if it did not take sufficient steps to preserve the videotape, and we don't have the machine here, but we do have the videotape. All videotapes come with this little tab right here. You simply move that tab, and it cannot be erased. Simply cannot. And we have that evidence in our brief. And so if...
You need to sum up, Mr. Huey.
So we would say that it should go back to the trial court. The trial court should first give the state an opportunity to come forward, and they're in the best position to do it. The officer has seen the videotape several times. Let them come forward and show that it would not have been exculpatory. Maybe the court's convinced, given all the other evidence, it wouldn't have been exculpatory. It wouldn't have been useful to them. That should be the state's...
Exculpatory or not, let's say it is exculpatory. Doesn't make a difference.
Yeah, that it would still be... It's plain error because there's no difference.
That's the material question, right?
Correct.
There are two words in there, material and exculpatory.
Correct.
And you seem to be hopping across material.
Absolutely. They would have to. They would be able to show that they could show that it's not material. They could show it's not exculpatory. They can also show that in some instances that it can be created. The defense could still create the evidence through some other source. Additionally, the trial court would not necessarily have to say, if they find for Mr. Loupartis, they wouldn't have to say this case is dismissed. We're simply saying the trial court should have the opportunity to consider that once the burden's on the right party. The trial court could say, look, we're going to suppress certain parts because you didn't give them the video of that part, but we're going to let them use the rest of the parts.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Huey. Mr. Sleeper, finally.
Mr. Chief Justice, opposing counsel, may it please the court. I think the important thing to remember here is sort of the big picture of what we're talking about. We're not just talking about a right to discovery for its own sake. Obviously, there's lots of evidence that defense counsel would like in all sorts of cases in order to defend the case. Well, the question is whether what they've been deprived of makes the process so fundamentally unfair that the state can no longer proceed with the prosecution. Because that's what they're arguing in their brief, is that the case must be dismissed because this piece of evidence is no longer present. And I think that's something to remember, because I think there's a whole host of remedies that help solve this problem that are short of saying that the case needs to be dismissed. I think the permissive inference that is talked about in Youngblood and the other case that I cited in my brief is a way of saying there was a piece of evidence, what was on that evidence is in dispute. If you find that the state is the one that destroyed it or didn't do what they're supposed to keep it, you can infer against the state that it was actually would have helped the defendant. And then you give the trier of fact, whether it's the court or a jury, an opportunity to evaluate the credibility of the officer in saying what happened to this piece of evidence, an opportunity to evaluate the credibility of the defendant saying, I performed these tests well, and you give them the opportunity then ultimately to decide what weight is to be given to this piece of evidence that was gone. I think that's
Are you suggesting that we write a rule of law that says if the state destroys it, there's a presumption that it would have been beneficial to the defendant, and instruct juries to that?
I don't think it's necessarily a presumption. I think it's a permissive inference. It's the same, for instance, in an OVI refusal case, there's a jury instruction that says a jury may, but they don't have to, consider that, well, the guy didn't take the breath test because he knew he was going to test over.
And so is that universal then? When there's a request for evidence and it's been destroyed, there would be a permissive inference? That's what you think we should write here?
I believe that's certainly one remedy short of saying that the case needs to be dismissed that I think adequately protects a defendant's
right. And then this
right
would be remanded for further proceedings at the trial court with that instruction that a trial court would instruct a jury if it would get that far.
I don't believe the case would need to be remanded to say that a permissive jury instruction could have been used had it gone to jury trial. I don't think we get that far if we say, first of all, the burden was properly left on Loupartis and he did not show that it was either materially exculpatory or potentially useful and destroyed in bad faith. I think we also don't get there if you say that the burden was on the state, but the findings of fact made by the trial court is enough to legally conclude that this piece of evidence was not materially exculpatory. I don't think what could have happened at a jury trial necessarily means it needs to be remanded for any further proceedings.
Counsel, are you saying that the bad faith issue evaporates when there is a discovery request and then the state destroys the evidence after the discovery request? I'm curious because you talk about this permissive inference, and that seems to suggest that you don't think bad faith is an issue here.
No, I apologize if I gave you that impression. The bad faith is certainly important into the determination of, first of all, who has the burden in the first place of proving the value of the lost or destroyed evidence. And second of all, if they can demonstrate bad faith, that's the end of the case, because if it's potentially useful, which we freely admit that it is, I mean, obviously there's something on the video that may have helped Mr. Loupartis. If they show bad faith, then that's a due process violation, and that's the end of it.
And that's the Geislin
right.
case. Okay.
Right. So if there's bad faith, but this is I think a crucial point in their discussion of who has the burden. Those cases.
So, counsel, just to be
sure
clear. If there's merely the statement that it was an accident or negligence, then you are advocating the potential for permissive inferencing and the instruction being given to the jury at that point.
I think it's possible that, yes, that could be given. And then the trier of fact is the one that then evaluates these stories of what happened to this particular piece of evidence.
But I guess I'm a little confused. Why would you need the permissive inference?
Well, I think it's just simply to say that it gives the defendant some protection to say, well, we wanted this piece of evidence. It's now gone, whether it's through any fault of the prosecutor or not. They can
you're
at
not
least
even
make that
gonna,
argument.
You then totally discard the materially exculpatory burden. It isn't placed on anybody to show that it was materially exculpatory or it wasn't.
No, I think what we're talking about is two separate things. Initially, in the motion to dismiss, That's when the question of material exculpatory and bad faith and those tests come into play. The question then is, well, if it has been destroyed and they don't fit either of these tests to require dismissal, is there some other remedy that can be used at jury trial that helps protect what the defendant's right to access evidence? And that's where they would be given the opportunity to argue, well, the jury should assume Mr. Loupartis looked great on these field sobriety tests, and that's why Trooper 4 she destroyed.
All right, when you're at that pretrial motion,
sure,
and you're examining materially exculpatory, who has the burden?
I believe that the burden is on the defendant. The defendant has the
and
burden
if the
to prove.
Defendant shows that the evidence was materially exculpatory, then what in your scenario?
Then that's a due process violation and the case must be dismissed.
Okay, and if it is shown not to be materially exculpatory?
If it's only potentially useful, the defendant has an opportunity to prove bad faith. If they prove bad faith again,
right,
you have a due process violation.
Let's say that they don't prove bad faith at that hearing.
Right.
Where does that leave us at trial?
Then I think that the evidence is the testimony of the officer is admissible about what was on that piece of evidence to talk about the performance on the field sobriety test and so forth. And at that point, then the defendant has an opportunity to argue, well, the video didn't show what you said it showed, Trooper Forshee, isn't that right? You reviewed it. He looked great. You realize that was different than what
you
testified to.
Don't
you
think you've got to have some testimony to that? Or?
Oh, certainly. Certainly. I mean, I think at that point, then they get their opportunity to present that issue to the finder of fact.
Well, how could that happen except for the defendant to take the stand? Or
I think it could also be done through cross-examination of the officer to say, you know, as they did in the motion hearing, they went through all the things that he did right on the tests, not just the things he did wrong. And so you go through and you say, well, you know, as we get all the time in OVI cases, did he pull over to the side of the road okay? Did he find his license okay? Did he get out of the car without stumbling? All those sorts of things. I think you could establish that testimony through the cross-examination of the officer without the defendant having to take the stand.
Doesn't that put the defendant at a real disadvantage? I mean, the defendant is trying to prove that the tape was materially exculpatory without a tape. So he has to somehow convince, without testifying, he doesn't want to test the trial, testify, he has to convince a jury or a judge, if it's a motion, that I really walked the line and I really did everything I was supposed to do properly, or the officer didn't follow the guidelines in administering the test to me. That's a very difficult burden, isn't it, when the state is responsible for having erased the tape?
I agree. I think
fair. It just seems unfair to me, just basically fundamentally unfair to me.
Sure, and I understand the concern. I think first of all, I want to say that, you know, the question of when we're determining whether it's materially exculpatory is something that would be in the pretrial hearing, so you're not requiring the defendant to testify at a jury trial.
But even there, how does he do that?
Right, and there's no doubt that it's a very difficult burden. I think the court cases repeatedly recognize that it's difficult to figure out what was on a piece of evidence that's no longer around. But what the question is, and what Mr. Loupartis' rule would have you decide, is that any piece of evidence that they request, if anything whatsoever happens to it, then that's a due process violation and it requires the outright dismissal of the case.
Well, I don't think she's saying, even if she's saying that, we don't have to accept that proposition. This is a tape,
right,
which is a pretty important piece of the evidence that's going to be should be offered to show that he didn't function properly.
Right.
And it's gone. And the reason it's gone is because the state made a mistake. Let's say, take the intentional, it's a mistake. The officer made a mistake. But it's the state's mistake. And we're saying to the defendant, you have to prove, or you have to show that this was materially exculpatory for me. I don't know how he does that.
Okay. And again, I mean,
but
I think
he's giving his word, but it's his word against the officer then.
Right, and I think in those situations we have to trust our trial judges to be able to evaluate the credibility of the two stories, to listen to what they say and determine based on how that fits in with other circumstances of the stop to evaluate their credibility and make that determination. And so I think you have to rely on the trial court who's in that position to look both people in the eye and listen to what they have to say and evaluate that. But I think what...
Counsel, I want to jump back to your inference. Explain that again. how you would save the day with an inference.
I just think that the after we get past who had the burden in the beginning and what the value of the evidence was, that at trial, a defendant can argue that there was a video that would have been the only objective piece of evidence to determine what actually happened. It was in the state's control. They reviewed it and they destroyed it. And what you ought to do is that casts a cloud over everything else the officer tells you.
But you would have us write that the defendant is entitled to, how did you phrase that again?
That there is a jury then is allowed to draw a permissive inference.
A permissive inference.
Right.
And the judge would tell the jury that they're entitled to a permissive inference that the missing evidence was exculpatory for the defendant.
That basically they can listen. They listen to everything what the officer says happened to it. They are permitted to draw, well, hey, they destroyed it, so.
Okay, well, I want to jump beyond OMVI to every other criminal case that you can imagine. I mean, if we write this rule for drunk driving, how do we put a fence around that and say, well, it makes sense when we're talking about a videotape in the cruiser, but it doesn't make sense, or we won't use that inference. The jury won't be told that there is a permissive inference that they may find that the missing photographs, the missing fingerprint evidence, the missing DNA there is an inference that the stuff the state lost was exculpatory for the defendant. How would you distinguish that between that and the missing video?
I guess I should first say that I don't think that the court even needs to get into the permissive inference and whether that's allowed.
Okay, well, that's my question.
Case.
I think you've just given up too much on behalf of every prosecutor.
Well, and I certainly don't want to do that, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that in this case, if the concern is, well, this is fundamentally unfair to a defendant, they have no other recourse, I think there are other recourses out there that are short of saying that this case must be dismissed because there's a due process violation in the destruction of the evidence.
Well, is it dismissed or send it back to a do-over? If we find in favor of the appellants here, it's not an outright dismissal of the charges. It's go back and see how you can construct your case given the fact that, you'd probably have to go through your initial hearings.
I don't think that the case necessarily would have to go back because I think that there are enough findings of fact in the trial court's determination that you can then take those and apply them to the legal standard of whether this meets bad faith and is potentially useful, or the legal standard of whether this is materially exculpatory. And I think that's where we get into all the other pieces of evidence that are not on the videotape.
So then we just have to answer the question about the shift of the burden of proof here. As to the materially exculpatory,
right.
I think just that little fact.
Well, I think
which
the trial
I think
court
is a little difficult, but go ahead.
I mean it's obviously a very complicated issue, but I think the trial court said the burden was on Mr. Loupartis. He did not show that it was exculpatory. He did not show that it was destroyed in bad faith.
Well, as the chief asked, how can you place that type of burden on a defendant to prove when there is no way of reconstructing that tape?
I agree, and again, I think we just have to go back to relying on our trial courts to be able to evaluate the credibility of what they hear and make that determination. I think, but I guess the flip side of the coin is, what if we just put the burden on the state to prove that, as they argue in the brief, that a piece of evidence is solely inculpatory? I think that upsets the balance as well, because it says anything that they request, if anything happens to it whatsoever, then that's a due process violation. I think that rule goes way too far in the other direction to say that anything they request that is now destroyed means that the state has no ability to even proceed on the charge.
Counsel, before you sit down, I want to ask a basic question. The General Assembly has changed the OMBI statute from what it was about 20 or 25 years ago when I was in the courtroom. There is now a per se violation if the concentration of alcohol in the blood is a certain amount. And then there is this one where it's under the influence of alcohol. What is the significance of a properly drawn and analyzed breath test under the section that we're talking about here today? Is there a presumption involved, or is it just evidence?
No, it's just in the per se charge, then the test is all you need to prove the per se charge. In the general under the influence charge, this court has said before that what you can do is have expert testimony to relate that test result to whether the person would have been appreciably under the influence of alcohol so that it would have impaired his ability to operate a motor vehicle. So there's an additional hoop to jump through, but that test result can still be used in a general under the influence prosecution.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Sleeper. Ms. Shigardis, you may take 30 seconds.
Very quickly, to go back to Justice O'Connor's question concerning what would happen if this went back to the trial court. If you review the trial court's opinion and finding of fact, in number 14, it says that defendant's assertions concerning his performance of the field sobriety test does no more than counter the officer's testimony concerning those same tests. If you apply the burden shifting under those findings of fact, if it's a 50-50 situation, when the burden's on the defendant loses. When the burden's on the state loses. So, and that's the reality. In terms of a remedy, what the state suggested in terms of shifting the burden of the proof to the state after that due process violation is shown, dismissal is not required. There are other remedies that the courts of appeals have crafted, including excluding the evidence that basically an exclusionary rule similar to the Miranda rule, where all evidence that came out of the confession and the fruits doctrine, they have applied that in these types of cases as well. Finally, I would simply note that we would not be here today, in my opinion, we would not be here today if the Court of Appeals had correctly acknowledged that there was a specific request in this case. The Court of Appeals takes issue with the fact that the state did not have adequate notice that the defendant wanted that, and that's why they did not address whether or not the burden should shift in this case. However, a review of the record reveals that there was a pretrial hearing set at which time defense counsel talked to the prosecutor and said, I want to review that videotape. The prosecutor said, okay, I will make sure that you can review that. And then the tape was subsequently destroyed.
Is that in the transcript that we have in the record here?
I beg your pardon?
Is that in the transcript?
Yes, that is in the transcript of the first motion hearing.
Thank you, Ms. Shigardis.
Counsel, before you sit down, I just have one very quick question, if I could. Is your argument that what you're asking for is required constitutionally, or that it would be the best policy, legal policy, for that to be the rule?
Both, because the due process clause of the United States Constitution demands is the fundamental fairness. And I believe that fundamental fairness demands here that when the state destroys evidence at its own hands, that the defendant specifically
requested. There's already
requested.
Been cases dealing with the constitutionality of that, and they're not the position that you're urging this court. So you're really asking this court to change those.
Actually, I would say that the black letter law that arises from Youngblood, for example, the black letter law that arises from there supports this conclusion, because in this case there was a specific request for a particular piece of evidence, and in Youngblood there was no particular request. This type of evidence is different than the type of evidence that was at issue in Youngblood.
Okay, thank you.
And Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.